Chapter 15. Closing the Hate Factories. Avoiding the Farce Feared by Madison. Facebook. The Hate Factory. Jan Fleischauer. Der Spiegel. October 2016. What they're doing, the POPs, or privately owned public spaces, is introducing all of these bad sites into our ecosystem and not having the means to monitor them appropriately and effectively. Mark Goldberg, Trust Metrics, December 2016. Providers have used the social media like a newspaper or a radio station to disseminate their opinions and messages without being subject to the provisions of the general press law. They should change quickly. Facebook should be like a publishing house. German Christian Democrats Party Chairman Ruprecht Polenz, December 2016. More so than in any year in American history, 2016 brought to realization the framers' fear that voters would be misled by innuendo, half-truths, and character assassination conducted by an unsympathetic foreign power. In Federalist 68, Alexander Hamilton explicitly and forcefully warned of events that eerily unfolded in 2016, where the presidential contest was possibly determined by cabal, intrigue, and corruption, chiefly from the desire in foreign powers to gain an improper ascendant in our councils. How could they better gratify this than by raising a creature of their own to the chief magistracy of the Union? Hamilton's fear of an electorate duped by nefarious foreign powers was just one element of the framers' pervasive fear of misinformed citizens. In rather sharp contrast with original intent, the GOP's operational manifesto is garner political power by appealing to voters with an afactual alternative narrative centered on fake news. That strategy includes demonizing the fact-based information industry central to the framers' vision of a democracy sustained by an informed electorate. The GOP manifesto rejects fact, truth, and political collaboration as pillars of American democracy. It is diametrically in opposition to the Constitution and original intent. Their manifesto has created a new era, featuring an American electorate increasingly exemplifying what the framers feared. Historians should look back with nostalgia at the relatively contained environment, comprised mostly of print and broadcast media, in which George Orwell and Alexander Solzhenitsyn labored to dissect and debunk the authoritarian's fake news of the 1930s and 1950s. Today's social media is a new and dangerous addition to the misinformation industry they confronted. More than 100 million Americans visit Facebook alone daily, far more than read newspapers, and comparable to TV as an information source. The Hate Factories. With content filtration meek, the social media platforms, or POPs, have become populated by not only you and your neighbors, but also by partisans, Kremlin propagandists, terrorist recruiters, white supremacists, psychopaths, and other traffickers seeking political gain, revenge, or to demean U.S. democracy. 20 years ago, they could only stand on a street corner and shout, unless owning a media property. Today, they can broadcast to billions from their living rooms. Malicious and mendacious postings are a minority on social media, but plentiful enough for Facebook to be labeled the hate factory. The lack of qualitative content censorship or filtration by the POPs has enabled this minority to expose democracies to the same dysfunction, antagonism, and disruption that followed the aggressive exploitation of the previous sensational new media innovation, radio, by European and Soviet authoritarians in the 1930s. The POPs have been slow in addressing even pathological content on their platforms, with fake news, killings, revenge porn, animal abuse, and the like routinely going viral within moments of posting. Twitter, for a time, permitted then-Breitbart editor Milo Yiannopoulos and pharmaceutical entrepreneur Martin Shkreli to harass online, respectively, an actress and an investigative reporter, including doctored photos. And it permits physical assaults on customers by online sociopaths deploying flashing animation to precipitate epileptic seizures among the vulnerable, attacks that American police too rarely investigate. Indeed, Twitter is an especially accommodating platform for psychopaths or partisans, easily accommodating anonymity. Moreover, its technical architecture is unusually vulnerable, enabling entrepreneurs to create hundreds of automated accounts or bots propagating similar themes, striving to land on Twitter's trending topics. Such coordination generates a Potemkin front of non-existent persons providing puppet masters with a cyberspace soundtrack. Samuel Woolley of Oxford University's Computational Propaganda Project explains, "Bots allow groups to speak much more loudly, to use Twitter as a megaphone, manufacturing consensus, or building the illusion of popularity for a candidate or a particular idea. This practice is hugely popular because practitioners and researchers have discovered that viewers have great difficulty distinguishing bots from humans. Recall, Oxford researchers concluded that about 20% of all political conversation they analyzed on Twitter in 2016 was merely bots. Twitter's efforts to strip terrorists and the like from its platform and rein in bots have been meek. In January 2017, angry relatives of the three Americans killed by ISIS, Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, attacks in Belgium and France, sued Twitter for failing to delete members of the terrorist organization from its platform. The suit alleged that Twitter played a uniquely essential role in the development of ISIS's image, its success in recruiting members from around the world, and its ability to carry out attacks and intimidate its enemies. ISIS cyber experts continued to use Twitter to plan and direct attacks abroad in 2017. Even more accommodating is Telegram, originally developed by Russian libertarians. Its military-grade encryption and secret chat rooms have proven ideal for global communications by Islamic State terrorists who laud its features and encourage followers to use it. Other POPs that have proven reluctant to censor neo-Nazis and the like are PayPal, GoFundMe, Patreon, and GoDaddy, facilitators of the racial confrontations in Charlottesville, Virginia, in August 2017. Facebook's track record is also discouraging. It failed to alert authorities in 2014 of information that could have prevented the murder by Islamist terrorists of British soldier Lee Rigby. A suicide and murders in Minnesota, Virginia, and Cleveland have been streamed, and police in Uppsala, Sweden, during January 2017, investigated the streaming of a sexual assault. Indeed, Facebook quite possibly influenced the presidential vote in 2016 by refusing to ban fake news postings. Intimidated by conservatives in the month before the election, it actually fired its team of content monitors. The Russian military, meanwhile, utilized Facebook marketing to craft pro-Trump and racist messaging. Posing as Americans, it fed propaganda hundreds of millions or billions of times to targeted voters before the election on Twitter, Facebook, and other POPs. Facebook on occasion has also mocked and intimidated critics of its permissiveness. BBC investigators uncovered Facebook postings involving child abuse in March 2017, for instance. After demanding the BBC investigators send it copies of the postings, Facebook officials refused to take them down and instead played gotcha, reporting the investigators to the police. Voluntary self-regulation failed. The POP's business model calls for maximizing user clicks by too readily dismissing ethical standards, journalistic safeguards, and a moral obligation to present the truth, censor hate speech, or, for PayPal and the like, deny funding for hate groups. Facebook has come to partner with fact-checkers to investigate complaints of offensive and bogus postings, deleting some or attaching alerts, and it does proactively veto some offensive postings, including nudity. But like other POPs, user complaints about offensive postings or images are mostly addressed belatedly after they have already gone viral. Moreover, its filtration system has been slow to mobilize. Facebook officials in Germany concluded, for instance, that anonymous online threats by one or more sociopaths to attack a female actor's face with a chainsaw had not violated our community standards. They refused to delete postings urging that war refugees be sent to gas chambers or that readers pour petrol over them, Syrian refugees, and set them on fire. In each instance, Facebook responded that complaints about these posts lack merit and that its refusal to delete them was no violation of German law by Facebook or its employees. This business model shields psychopaths, Kremlin propaganda, and fake news from the sort of explicit content accountability that print journalists or broadcasters face under German law, where even printing malicious letters to the editor can cause a publication to be closed. Pushed by German officials, the POPs responded by agreeing in mid-2016 to voluntary self-filtration of content. The results were underwhelming. During the fourth quarter of 2016, only 40% of flagged content was even reviewed by the POPs within 24 hours, and only 28.3% of such content was removed. Overall, Facebook deleted less than one-half of hate speech postings, despite the fact that German law obligates social media platforms to promptly delete postings inciting violence or slandering another person upon complaint. In contrast, the more responsible YouTube platform removed 90% of objectionable content flagged by users within 24 hours. Justice Minister Heiko Maas summarized the experiment this way. Too little illegal content is being deleted, and it's not being deleted sufficiently quickly. The biggest problem is and remains that the networks don't take the complaints of their own users seriously enough. His frustration led to the German January 2018 network enforcement law that imposes fines of up to 50 million euro on larger social media platforms failing to delete illegal or offensive speech, hate speech, or fake news within 24 hours. The officials simply extended rules applicable to print and broadcasters to social media platforms as well. Structuring the censorship obligation in this manner mimics, in some measure, the successful American procedure under the Fairness Doctrine, although the German process remains reactive rather than ex ante, a huge shortcoming. In France, it took similar severe pressure from officials fearing the impact of fake news and Russian propaganda on voters in 2017 for the POPs to begin aggressive monitoring of French language postings. Some 15 POPs, including Facebook and Google, eventually partnered with Le Monde in the cross-check initiative. The situation is little better in America, where cyber targets have redress only through cumbersome and expensive libel laws or privacy statutes. The successful suit by billionaire Peter Thiel, fronted by Terry Bollea, Hulk Hogan, involving fake news disseminated by the website Gawker, consumed years, $10 million, hinged on a hometown jury and defendants, owners of Gawker, who were Americans and thus reachable by U.S. courts. Remediating the offensive content of the POPs is low on the agenda of the Trump administration. But American corporations, including financial firms and Starbucks, have increasingly become targets of cyber attacks. That has generated interest in corralling fake news that propagates globally at lightning speed. Costco no longer taking memberships. Xbox killed a teenager. Some 12 of Snopes' top 50 fake news attacks were targeted at firms, reported the Financial Times. Leading European governments have become more proactive, insistent that the EU require dramatically better content accountability from the POPs. German Economic Minister Brigitte Zupris has called for laws against fake news and hate mongering, explaining that soft regulation privatizes justice. Referring to evil material, Theresa May demanded in September 2017 that industry needs to go further and faster, developing technological solutions which prevent it being uploaded in the first place. This European pressure has forced the POPs to react more aggressively in evaluating questionable postings. New tools, algorithms, and thousands of sensors have been added. The POPs have the technical and financial capability to censor ex ante all content. Thus far, they have only selectively adopted ex-ante censorship, relying on algorithms that have proven easily gamed and bypassed. Comprehensive content censorship is most likely to begin in Europe and with video content. Including YouTube, the POPs may perhaps soon be required to meet the same rules applicable to broadcasters. Hate speech, fake news, incitement to terror, and the like could be required to be rejected ex ante through revisions to the audiovisual media services regulations. Expunging fake news from all media platforms. The pathological, fake, and partisan news carried by the POPs has darkened the visionary goals of entrepreneurs like Twitter co-founder Evan Williams to make the world a better place. To realize that vision, governments must cease abdicating content filtration to market forces. Their challenge is no different from confronting environmental polluters or drug dealers, who privatize profits while socializing the harmful costs of their practices and products. With social media, that cost is measured in the loss of individual privacy and contentment, as well as diminution in the quality of information available to citizens and voters. It is also measured in the steadily thinning newsrooms of the fact-based mainstream media, struggling with online competitors who themselves eschew expensive investigative and watchdog reporting. The time-honored solution of economists in situations like this, where market forces underprice social costs, is to raise that price with penalties or through regulation on suppliers. Adopting a nuanced and comprehensive approach drawing on that traditional economic principle is warranted to address the failures of the POPs market. Educators and parents should address the issue of fake news in schools, around the kitchen table, and elsewhere. For example, Bamse, the popular Swedish children's comic strip, has sought to teach youths to distinguish between fact and fake news and to question all internet content. Mainstream media should continue to aggressively identify fake news stories and nourish fact-checking initiatives patterned on Le Monde's Décodex and the BBC's Reality Check. The public sector should require that content on POPs platforms not be poisonous, meet community standards, and be factual, ingredients central to a high-quality democracy. That creates a bias toward ex-ante censorship. Policy advocacy, political ads should be limited, ex-ante filtered, and held to the same attribution standards as print and broadcast media, including identification of funders. Exceptions for individual political speech should be considered. In democracies imposing limits on electioneering spending, political information and opinion disseminated on social media threaten to derail the positive character of their political campaigns. Specific bans or limits on social media for all political speech in such countries are appropriate. Social media should not become a loophole, enabling corporate or independent entities to evade existing limits on political speech or issue advocacy during elections. Automated bots should be eliminated from cyberspace, following the pattern set by political parties in Germany. The POPs such as PayPal that process payments should also be required to delete users promoting hate speech or fake news. All POPs should be required to obtain explicit user permission to disseminate their cyberspace data. The German government is perhaps most advanced in this direction, aided by its existing thorough press law that lays out responsibilities and rights for information disseminators. Handelsblatt journalist Dietmar Neuerer explains the fundamental principle being promulgated is that derogatory information and opinion on social media is violative of the nation's free speech guarantee. No one is entitled to freedom of expression, to violate the rights of others, for example, by inciting them to violence or to slander them. These laws apply. They must be applied more consistently in social networks than before. Justice Minister Maas agrees. The providers of social networks are responsible when their platforms are misused to spread hate crime or illegal false news. Tabea Rusna, a leading Green Party official, explained their logic. Social platforms were initially not press companies with editorial responsibility, but have become a crucial part of the opinion-forming process. The Christian Democratic Party's parliamentary chairman, Ruprecht Polenz, concurs. Providers have used the social media like a newspaper or a radio station to disseminate their opinions and messages without being subject to the provisions of the general press law. That should change quickly. Facebook should be like a publishing house. American internet experts agree in some measure. Wired journalist Emma Gray Ellis concluded in April 2017, for instance, that the only way to kill revenge porn is to stop it being posted in the first place. Pops' censorship of social media communications may offend many Americans, but it will not run afoul of their First Amendment rights shielding nearly all speech content. That right entitles one to opine on street corners and precludes the government from censoring your commentary on any media, including social media. But the media platforms themselves can legally act as censors in America and in Europe, as explained by law professors Margot Kaminsky of Ohio State and Kate Klonick of Yale Law School. Indeed, media platforms are routinely sued for not adequately censoring offending content. Media proprietors, including the POPs, are obligated neither to lend you megaphones nor to publish or otherwise broadcast your musings or opinion. Referring to media organizations, Kyle Pope, editor and publisher of the Columbia Journalism Review, explained, "It's totally within their rights to set ground rules and to set standards in choosing what advertisements and news they air or publish." As an industry, the POPs differ only technologically from print or broadcast media platforms, and their content should be subject to ex ante or ex post review as appropriate. The original justification for the Fairness Doctrine requirement for broadcast censorship was the U.S. role in fostering broadcasting technology. And the same compelling logic applies to cyberspace disseminators as well. Moreover, adoption of a filtration regime would align the POPs with common practice in many areas of American governance and society. Protocols and procedures to ensure dissemination of nonpartisan, fact-based information are common in the fields of national security, transportation, medicine, food and equipment safety, and a host of other applications that involve scientific investigation and development. They are intended to ensure that security and intelligence officials, judges, medical researchers, clinicians, pesticide safety investigators, transportation managers, environmental engineers, legislators, NASA engineers and public officials are exposed to the wisdom derived from evidence-based, unbiased, and nonpartisan information. Voters, the ultimate stakeholders and arbiters of American governance, are entitled to no less. Proactive censorship of cyberspace is controversial, but will not disrupt the vast bulk of interpersonal communications. Indeed, POPs like Facebook and Google may seek to rebuild reputational damage in seizing the competitive advantage offered by providing users a credible platform rather than a grimy scrum. Content censorship is justified by the existential risks noted by Madison and others that are posed to democracy by a misinformed citizenry. The challenge is to find their aspirational information sweet spot, that universe where mostly factual information is enjoyed by citizens practicing free speech, free of distortion, free of self-serving filtration by government, and free of slander, hate speech, and fake news. Admittedly, it is uncertain how technically comprehensive a regime to censor social media can be. Delisting by Facebook, PayPal, GoDaddy, Google, and others sent white supremacist websites scurrying to platforms such as Gab.ai, Hatron, and WeSearcher during the latter half of 2017. Desperate to remain accessible, the Daily Stormer, for instance, shifted to Tor, a browser for anonymous web surfing, then to a Russian server, then to Cloudflare, from which it was also soon booted. Flitting through the dark web certainly limits accessibility, which is important. Yet it will take the cooperation of state actors like Russia to achieve an effective cyber censorship regime, not to mention support by the Republican Party. Judging by behaviors in 2016, it seems evident that neither is inclined to see fake news and the like stripped from cyberspace. Quite the contrary. The dangers of loopholes in content accuracy standards. Ideally, content standards should apply impartially across all media platforms. Britain offers an example of the consequences of standards that are not comprehensively applied. It insists on a due impartiality standard for broadcasters, but not for newspapers or social media. That print loophole has been exploited by the fittest, including Rupert Murdoch. As a newspaper proprietor, he enjoys a judicially affirmed right, as in Australia and America, to discredit the disfavored and skew public opinion as much as his wallet and conscience allow. In one instance, Murdoch placed a large picture in color of political opponent Kevin Rudd, professionally photoshopped in a Nazi uniform, on the front page above the fold of Australia's most widely read newspaper weeks before an election. Such antics provide an important lesson. If any loophole is permitted, the outcome will mimic experience in Britain, with consequences all too familiar to Americans. The type of opinionated and polarized news that is now a feature in U.S. television and radio has for years been found in the U.K. print media, explained Jacob Rowbottom in The New Republic. If special interests are often cast as the villains of U.S. politics, media proprietors play an equivalent role in the U.K. In the U.S., candidates, parties, and special interest groups spend huge sums of money to gain an advantage in the ad wars. By contrast, the most vicious political messages in the U.K. tend to be found in the pages of the tabloid newspapers. The newspapers are the only outlet that can engage in electoral advocacy without restraint from either spending controls or content regulation. As a result, whoever controls the newspapers has a much greater capacity to steer the course of an election debate. Given the relatively small number of titles with a national audience and levels of concentration, this influence lies in the hands of a small number of companies. News Corporation alone has over a third of the market share for national newspapers. This explains why so many politicians went out of their way to win the favor of Rupert Murdoch and his lieutenants. This predicament highlights the challenge of integrating political and policy advocacy carried on social media with any system of limits on electioneering and broadcast spending. Laws in higher quality democracies that limit campaign spending do not address social media advertising or communications as a rule. Thus, regulators in these countries face new challenges in crafting limits on the volume of political communications by any individual or organization over social media. A further challenge is posed by the emerging practices labeled psychometrics, noted earlier, designed to sway voters using data surreptitiously seized from cyberspace. Russia, U.S. politicians, and the Mercers garner data revealed by cyber interactions, what would seem to be an abuse of privacy by the pops. Facebook, for example, refused to sell most user information until 2012. Today, personal and credit card interactions are just another industry revenue stream, widely marketed without user permission. As exploited during the Brexit vote, noted earlier, this prized personal data enabled partisans to classify individual voters by their pet peeves and preferences. That is how some 600,000 targeted Brits came to be bombarded by a billion individualized, misleading, or even mendacious appeals. The POPs should voluntarily end this abuse of privacy, ceasing to compile or market data on users. Lacking an effective response, the democracies should ban this invasive exploitation of social media users. This reform will need to be led by the higher quality democracies such as Germany, because the Trump administration is opposed. Soon after taking office, it torpedoed an Obama administration regulation requiring internet providers to obtain customer permission before tracking and commercializing their online habits. Fact-based reporting should be complemented with high-quality reporting. Another concern is the erosion of fact-based reporting, as resources at mainstream media enterprises are drawn away by social media. Quality factual reporting is thriving in a few fact-based media organizations like the New York Times and Washington Post, which have successfully adapted to the cyber revolution. But they are the exception. An example is the American Center for Public Integrity, including its branch through the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, ICIJ. Although they are the source of numerous exposés, including the Panama Papers, which has reduced the use of international tax havens, they lack an adequate financial base. Despite their fundamental value to societies, the same challenge exists for other investigators, such as ProPublica or the Marshall Project's work on criminal justice. Ideally, a regime requiring more socially responsible behavior by the POPs should include social media platforms directing resources to the expansion of what Richard Hazen terms the checking activity, fact-checking and unveiling the truth while holding dissemblers accountable. That seminal obligation of mainstream journalism has inspired remarkable reporting on many occasions, including Carl Fleming and Claude Sitton reporting on institutionalized abuse and homicide during Jim Crow, Edward R. Murrow reporting on the demagogic Joseph McCarthy, or Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein on Watergate. Such truth-telling requires an idealized, significant set of skills and traditions, explains University of Alabama law professor Paul Horowitz. Before a story is published, every line, every quote, every judgment call is subjected to checking and rechecking, debate and counter-debate, and institutional second-guessing. University of Chicago economist Luigi Zingales has argued that such an aggressive independent media, professional, objective, and free of bias, is vital in limiting abuse and corruption by government and powerful interests. The private and nonprofit sectors are actively searching for business models that support the preservation of objective journalism, and they are seeking innovative new ways to collaborate with social media platforms that increasingly dominate news dissemination. One successful, if ad hoc, approach has been for citizens to directly support online independent investigative journalism, exemplified by the French venture Mediapart, or by Philadelphia's H.F. Lenfest's support of The Inquirer, The Daily News, and Philly.com. Another example is eBay founder Pierre Omidyar, who donated $100 million in 2017 to support a number of independent investigative entities, including $4.5 million to the ICIJ. George Soros has also donated to efforts resisting fake news. And Wikipedia's founder, Jimmy Wales, is raising capital for a new global news organization called WikiTribune to expose fake news. These efforts to enhance fact-based reporting and the checking function can be dramatically accelerated if the POPs themselves begin in-house investigative reporting. The more widespread the watchdog or checking activity on all American media platforms, including the POPs, the closer the nation will come to realizing the framers' intent for an informed electorate. Restoring the quality of American democracy. A global retreat from democracy is well underway, with nations such as Hungary, Mozambique, Poland, and Turkey growing more authoritarian of late. Indeed, 2016 was the 11th year in a row that the Freedom House Matrix noted earlier documented that the reach of global democracy has diminished. This certainly reflects, in some measure, America's retreat from global leadership, beginning with the humiliating 2000 election and the Iraq War of Choice. That retreat is reflected in the Freedom House's rather dismal ranking of 32nd place in 2016 for American democracy, as noted in Chapter 8. It removed America from the top rank of democracies due to the cumulative impact of flaws in the U.S. electoral system, a disturbing increase in the role of private money in election campaigns, and the legislative process, legislative gridlock. The last chapter provides recommendations to remediate these deficiencies. They are the steps needed to raise the quality of American democracy, enabling the nation to join the ranks of peer wealthy nations in prioritizing the prosperity of all its citizens.